Well, we're never short of material, we find, for our monthly feature of Foreign Affair. This is the third instalment of our new series where we explore the most important developments in foreign relations in the last month, and I do thank you for all your responses too. Most gratifying. Our aim is to chew the fat around developments in our world that, yes, may get maybe bald headline coverage, but don't necessarily tease out some of the underlying factors at stake, which of course can affect conditions of war or peace and what prevails, so they matter. In other words, so we ask each guest to nominate what they see as the most significant event over the last month, and then we all have a chance to wrestle with some of the implications. My guests this month are Michael Wesley, Melissa Connolly-Tyre and Tom Switzer. Michael's no stranger to Saturday Extra listeners. He's Professor of International Affairs and Dean of the College of Asia and the Pacific at the ANU. Melissa is the National Executive Director of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. And Tom Switzer is my colleague, the presenter of both Between the Lines and Sunday Extra, and keenly interested, as you'll know, in US domestic and foreign policy and how it interacts with Australia. So welcome to you all.
Good morning, Geraldine.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Michael, to you first, and I know that the whole drama over North Korea has kept you completely preoccupied. Let's listen to some of the Trump decision-making. We had a bit to choose from, but here's one example of his language and approach.
The status quo in North Korea is also unacceptable, and the Council must be prepared to impose additional and stronger sanctions on North Korean nuclear and ballistic missile programs. This is a real threat to the world, whether we want to talk about it or not. North Korea is a big world problem, and it's a problem we have to finally solve. You know, people have put blindfolds on for decades, and now it's time to solve the problem.
Now, Michael, what was your reaction to that very blunt assessment of the situation?
Oh, look, it's been fascinating, Geraldine. As you say, I've been transfixed by this. I think the big anomaly in the early days of the Trump presidency has been North Korea. While pretty much everyone else in the world, with the possible exception of Bashar al-Assad, has been keeping their head down and trying not to provoke this very provocable new US president, the real anomaly here has been Kim Jong-un and his deliberate provocations of the United States, which have led to that particular statement by Trump. I think we are all too quick to just dismiss Kim as being irrational. I think the much better way to look at this is to say that he is a supremely rational actor. And in fact, he is reacting to Trump's unpredictability. If you think about the statements that Trump made about Northeast Asia, about his comfort with Japan and South Korea acquiring nuclear weapons, and his various other statements about alliances in the region, I think what Kim is actually doing by provoking Trump is trying to draw him out and make Trump much more predictable in Northeast Asia.
I was really struck, and I'll call get our other guest to come in, by Mike Pence, who was, of course, here last week, saying, we do not wish to bring Kim Jong-un on to his knees. We want to bring him into the fold. I thought that was an interesting distinction, you know, Tom Switzer. I thought that was quite well put.
Yes, although I think the failure here on the part of Washington and indeed Canberra is a failure to recognise why Kim wants nuclear weapons. I mean, from North Korea's perspective, not from our perspective, but from North Korea's perspective, it's perfectly rational for Pyongyang to develop nuclear weapons. Why? Because they're seen as the ultimate deterrent. And when they see Trump striking at Assad, Syria, as he did a few weeks ago, when they see the United States try to topple Saddam Hussein's Iraq in 2003, Colonel Gaddafi's Libya in 2011, that provides a powerful incentive for the North Koreans to develop nuclear weapons as the ultimate deterrent.
So, but still leaves it immensely dangerous, doesn't it? So what is a US president to do?
Well, my view is that containment can work. I mean, containment worked against a nuclear Soviet Union. It worked against Mao Zedong. It worked against Iraq from the time of the Gulf War in 91 right through to the invasion of 2003. I think containment, deterrence, diplomacy carry risks. But nevertheless, the risks are fewer than they are by striking at Pyongyang or pushing for regime change.
Melissa.
Well, I think that sense of the danger of the situation is very, you know, very key. We have a delegation here at the moment from South Korea, from the Korea Foundation, and they've been talking about this as an unprecedented threat to security. And when a South Korean says unprecedented, I take that seriously, because their threshold is, you know, pretty high. They're used to living with the volatility to their north. For them, the change factor is very much the US and what will the US do? What do you take from the rhetoric? And there's, I think, a real sense of fear that the US just could do something disastrous.
And then the artillery shells go straight out over South Korea.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, the casualties are honestly don't bear thinking about. And there's nothing you can do. Once artillery is shot off, that you can't intercept it. Like, there's no very clever missile system intercepts artillery.
Mm. Yeah, I think the consensus here is that there's no viable military solution here, because if we did strike at North Korea, they could use nuclear weapons in response. They could use a formidable conventional artillery to strike at Seoul. China would probably get involved, and there's no telling where that could go.
Well, isn't that it, Michael? No, isn't this really hugely designed, the American behaviour, to draw the Chinese in, to get Xi Jinping in?
Look, it is. North Korea is essentially the suicide bomber of international relations.
It's been
doing this for 30 years now. Essentially, their strategy is to be so fragile and yet so dangerous that they're telling the rest of the world, put too much pressure on us and we will collapse and we will take all of our neighbours, including China, with us. So I think we should be careful about overestimating how much China can do here. I think Kim's nuclear weapons program is as much signalling to China that you cannot pressure us as it is to the United States and its allies as well. And so certainly China is a big part of this, but I think we have to realise that the Chinese levers of pressure on North Korea are very, very limited as well.
And just before we leave it, therefore, where are we? Like, if Pence is right, we want to draw him into the fold, this young man. How can that be done?
Look, I think we're at a delicate kind of balance of irrationalities here, or unpredictabilities. You've got Kim's unpredictability versus Trump's unpredictability, and each of them is kind of betting that the other one will blink first. I think the statements such as that of Pence that you quoted, Geraldine, are exactly what Kim wants to hear. He wants the United States to acknowledge that it has taken the military option off the table, that containment is the way to go. That's exactly what he wants. On the other hand, the more unpredictable Trump is, the more he's got Kim worried. The other thing that I wouldn't take off the table is how domestically fragile the Kim regime might be. His viciousness in dealing with his regime allies over past months suggests a dictator that's very, very worried.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. Who can speak truth to power? Because they just get executed very fast by awful means. Okay, and now you, Melissa, simply could not avert your gaze from the French election, the vote for Marine Le Pen and what it suggests about the mood of the people in that country and elsewhere. Now, as it turns out, she didn't do quite as well as some had thought, but of course there's another round to come. Here's a reminder of her approach on election night earlier in the week.
The first step which should lead France to the Élysée is already covered. It's a historical result, and it's for me to take on board the enormous responsibility of defending France, being responsible for its culture, its prosperity, its independence, and its security. Long live the Republic, long live France, and long live the population and the people of France.
Yes, now, Melissa, this just completely, that whole last phrase of hers, long live France and the people of France, which is just exactly what Jonathan Haidt, the US analyst, was saying to us earlier in the program about this perceived importance by nationalists or localists about feeling that they've got their country that they recognise. Do you think this which is clearly on the march, is changing the people in foreign affairs and the way they think about their choices?
Absolutely. And look, this is why I chose this. In some ways, it's the dog that didn't bark. You know, Marine Le Pen did not come first. She came a close second. And at this point, I think relatively few think that she'll win in the second round in a two-horse race, though no one is ever prepared to say never. What I suppose I find interesting about this is just how closely it was watched in Australia, as were, you know, previous elections in, say, Austria or Netherlands, for this populism factor. And I feel there's a sort of spirit of our times which is the feeling that the world is changing, that the consensus we had about how to run things is breaking down, that there's this tide of populism and it's taking over. And there's, I think, a real sense of fear and uncertainty, which means each election is watched closely for further signs that our international order is unravelling.
Yeah, Tom, you guys.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that I think that Melissa's absolutely right. And I think that although the consensus is probably right that Macron will defeat Le Pen on May 7, and nevertheless, France has some real sense of anxiety about where its place is in the world. Mm. Just its domestic economy. Growth is still around 1% a year. Mm. Unemployment's more than 10%. Youth unemployment is 25%. And when you add to this the very real threats of Islamist terror, mass migration from Syria, you can understand why so many French people are very anxious about their country. The expectations are on Macron to fix that. If he doesn't, Le Pen will still be there.
True.
I'm less inclined to kind of write this election off for Le Pen at the moment, though. I mean, I'm not so keen on the term populism, because I think populism is used to describe a lot of things. I think what people like Le Pen and Trump and others are really riding on is a tide of anti-elitism. And if anything, Macron, despite painting himself as an outsider, is, you know, your carbon copy, you know, central casting elite. This is a guy who couldn't be better designed to be an elite. And if you look at what happened with the workers and that rally yesterday and his kind of completely ham-fisted, 10-eared response to it, if he has many more days like that, my goodness, I think...
Yeah, but to be fair, Michael, how would you respond to the counter-argument that the National Front Party has a toxic history of anti-Semitism, hostility to minorities and immigrants, and that puts a ceiling on Le Pen's appeal?
Sure, and that's the big drawback here. I think you're right, Tom. If Macron gets through this time, it's going to be a big ask for him to turn things around. And maybe next time the anti-elitist candidate will not be a Le Pen, but will be someone without that toxic history, who will be much more palatable to voters.
Yes. Look, I suppose I think what is intriguing about it is the whole question of security, say, because she referred to that, the security of France. And I don't actually know what she means, if you know what I mean, but whether, in fact, that animates people who are broadly put into the populist area, like, or whether they, like, maybe it's jobs that animates them, but is it really national security, do you think, Tom? Because surely... this is what I've never understood. You would want the best, especially over in Europe, and we're going to come to that in a moment where I've just been, you want the best qualified person to keep your country safe. That's surely top of mind.
Yes, but France has been subjected to some very serious terror attacks in recent years. But it's not just the threat from illegal immigration and terror. It's also globalisation. There's a widespread fear in France, and it goes beyond ideology, goes beyond left and right, that globalisation, technological change has displaced a lot of the working class folks. Le Pen is doing well, not just in the traditional National Front strongholds in the south of France, but she's now doing very well in the traditional socialist strongholds of northern France, where a lot of factories have been closed down. So she's appealing to folks who have been displaced by globalisation. It's not just a fear of immigrants or Islamic terror, it's also globalisation.
Yes, Melissa.
Yeah, and so it's definitely part of these, you know, tides of nationalism. The question there, of course, is how much safer does it make people?
Well, that's why I think it's such an interesting tension, because, as I was going to say later, and I will, but the memory of war is so much stronger when you're over there in the Northern Hemisphere than it is here. I was really struck by it. I've just been on a short holiday. And that's why I find this rather strange, because people know that their fathers went to war or they were landed on, you know, Sword Beach sort of thing, and the French know that they lost, you know, half of their country. So this is not a notional theoretical thing.
No, look, I think it's also a sense of that it's the viability and legitimacy of the French state that's at stake here. Mm. You know, you walk through Paris and you see teeming, particularly around the landmarks, teaming crowds of immigrants and security personnel and so on and so forth. And I think a lot of people in France are saying, whatever happened to the state's ability to control who comes in and what they do, and even better, to hold out the promise of a better life for the people of France.
Well, they shouldn't have had an empire then, should they? You know,
but I think a lot of it is that pulling back sovereignty. So the way the next round of the French election's looking is it's turning much more into a referendum on the future of France within the EU. You're having a repeat of the Brexit discussions.
Mm. And they're much more pro-Europe than the British are.
Yes, absolutely. Historically, that's definitely true. Mm. But
well, I mean, to an extent, but I think there has been a failure across Europe to celebrate the positives of the European Union. That's certainly what happened in Britain, and I think you can pick that up in public opinion polling in France and Germany and other places as well, that, you know, the European Union is accepted as a kind of a something you have to bear, but the real positives, no one's been out there as the real pro-European candidate for a very long time.
Although Macron, correct me if I'm wrong, is pro-EU, he's unashamedly pro-Brussels.
Yeah, and I think the man in the Netherlands man was too, who got up, if you recall.
The mainstream
center, you know, in Germany, of course, you know, the right is just falling apart, as it is in Britain, the really extreme right, completely falling apart. So
I suppose the point to bear in mind, though, is those conditions that gave rise to this nativism, they're not going away,
no,
are they?
No,
but we'll see. Yes, look, far be it from me to predict anything. I've lost all my confidence.
We all have, Geraldine.
Now, Tom, it was, and I just should tell listeners, Foreign Affair. We're at our April Foreign Affair, and my guests are Michael Wesley, Melissa Connolly-Tyre, and Tom Switzer. And Tom, it was actually much earlier this month, and it's been somewhat overtaken by events. But for you, the US missile strike on Syria and its aftermath are simply full of portent. Here's how we learned about it that dramatic day.
The night I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched. It is in this vital national security interest of the United States to prevent and deter the spread and use of deadly chemical weapons. Years of previous attempts at changing Assad's behavior have all failed, and failed very dramatically.
So, Tom, why do you think this must be fully examined?
Well, I think, there were 59 Tomahawk missiles that the United States hurled at Syria. I think, all things considered, it was largely symbolic in response to the Assad regime's alleged chemical weapons attack. I say alleged because it hasn't been proven beyond doubt that the Assad regime...
Do you really think that?
Well, why would the Assad regime do it? Look, they probably did it, but we still haven't had...
It was a mistake, wasn't it?
Well, there's different interpretations, but the point I would make is that despite that symbolic act by the president, President Trump, the Assad government and the Russians are still winning the Syrian civil war. They control all four major towns, Damascus, Aleppo, Homs and Humes. There are something like 16 million Syrians today. I think 10, 11 million of them live in Assad regime-controlled areas, 2 million under the Syrian Kurds, 2 million under Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, and another 1 million from non-Assad Sunni rebellion groups. So the Assad regime is winning the civil war, and I think, all things considered, it will win the civil war, and the Trump administration would be foolhardy to try to change that.
But what people have suggested is that that one-off was probably a highly effective warning to him and his, this is Assad,
yeah,
and his people, that they're not going to get away with this, and possibly even to Putin, and that it actually was incredibly clever sort of containment, to use your phrase, you know?
Well, I mean, certainly I think that it was a warning to Damascus and Moscow, because full-scale American intervention against Assad is the one thing that would deny him victory in this war. But I don't see there's any evidence to indicate that the Americans are serious about changing the balance of power, particularly when you consider that the main enemy of Assad among the Sunni rebels are Islamic State and Al-Qaeda jihadists, the very folks we are supposed to be fighting in Syria.
Sure. So for people... Yes, go on, Melissa.
I was going to say, I agree. I think it's, you know, not likely that this is going to change anything on the ground, and the view is that it's predominantly symbolic.
But hang on, just before we let that go through, because what I had read was that the only way that Assad, who I think there's no doubt is winning, reacts to anything, and in terms of not using the little bit of residue of chemical weapons he's got left, is by things like this, that actually force does play a role in the Middle East, even though all of us find it extremely unpalatable to confront that.
But remember, the Russians and the Iranians are supporting the Assad regime, and that they've gained the upper hand in the civil war as well. The Americans have basically been bystanders despite this Tomahawk missile attack.
Oh, look, my view, Geraldine, is that while I broadly agree with Tom, I think win is a very big word, and we need to unpack that a little bit. I think the prospects of Assad establishing and his allies establishing complete uncontested control of all of Syria's territory is very slim. I think that we are still looking at some sort of negotiated end to this war. Mm. I think there are areas in Syria in which particularly the Al-Qaeda forces are actually staging a very strong comeback. Mm. And one of the interpretations of that chemical weapons attack is that Assad was desperate around that particular area to kind of close up a salient that had been opened up by the Al-Qaeda forces.
Yeah, they were doing quite well there.
But I think you're broadly right. The United States, despite lobbing in cruise missiles, has shown no appetite for expanding its role in the war.
Melissa?
Yeah, well, I'm interested, I suppose, in what I see as the biggest impact, which is on Russia-US relations. I think that's a place where it's had significant immediate response. I'm also interested, I suppose, in the domestic side, in, you know, what signal that sent to Trump supporters, both at a time when he's fighting allegations around his closeness to Russia, and also just in general the number of supporters who thought he was going to be a different president and not do this sort of lobbing bombs at other countries. But look, he's just like the rest.
Mm. Look, again, when I was away, I spoke to German people who they've accommodated almost a million refugees, and there's extraordinary debates about just how well they've done, but it certainly isn't the hot issue that it was last year. But people I spoke to claim that a lot of the Syrian refugees want to go home, the people in Germany. They want to return to Syria. Some of them are still sort of accommodated in very makeshift dwellings in Germany, which has behaved remarkably well. But I wonder, Melissa, you know, whether this is... We don't hear much about this, do we? And the utter tragedy of all of those displaced people, not desirous of life in the West,
absolutely,
who want to go back to their neck of the woods.
And that's true in the case of almost all refugee movements. People don't leave unless they feel they genuinely have no choice. They wish to stay where they are. And if Syria could be, you know, stabilised, there would be a large proportion, if they felt comfortable of their safety, who would want to return. The question is, how do we get to a stable Syria? And I don't think we have a better answer to that now than we did at the start of the conflict.
Just before we leave this, Tom, I mean, from your knowledge, is there any suggestion that the Sergei Lavrov, you know, the Russian foreign minister, relationship with Tillerson is anything like the one between John Kerry and Lavrov, who I always thought was very interesting to watch the two of them? I mean, could they pull off, you know, a remarkable Paris peace deal or something at the end of the Vietnam War?
Well, anything's possible with Donald Trump and his administration, but what we've seen already is remarkable U-turns. I mean, I've joked about this before, but the power of his U-turn and reverse gear are up to best international standards. I mean, seriously. I mean, Trump throughout the last year was distinguishing himself from Hillary Clinton and most Republicans on various foreign policy issues, but especially the war in Syria.
Sure.
Yeah. He actually supported the Russian effort in Syria to defeat the Islamic State jihadists. But by launching these 59 Tomahawk missiles on Syria, and then having the Secretary of State Tillerson go to the Kremlin to say that this is the lowest of lows in the relationship between the Kremlin and Washington in the post-Cold War era, that shows that U-turns and reverse gears are up to best international standards indeed.
Well, look, I'm going to, yes, gorgeous little slogans there. Look, I did notice this sense I reflected earlier. I was standing in the immigration queue at Gatwick Airport as the news flash came through about Theresa May's snap election, which was quite remarkable. I sensed a lot more brittleness within the Northern Hemisphere among quite a few citizens as to whether they feel the world is safe and whether it'll stay that way. You know, far more than our neck of the woods. We've got the South China Sea just up there and North Korea. But we seem to me, Michael Wesley, to feel it's a much more theoretical, I don't know whether it's our sense of a great and powerful friend, you know, what Alan Gingell was writing about recently. I mean, do you sense this among Asians?
I think Asians, and I'd include Australia here, are much more pragmatic about our relationship with the United States. Europeans really do feel values or have felt a values connection to the United States for a very long time. I think in our part of the world, it's not really about values. It's about the sheer facts of power and utility. And for that reason, I think we're less disquieted by Trump and his obvious failings in the values field than Europeans are. And so I think this election of a US president that has really taken the United States away from that kind of liberal internationalism that we had come to assume imbued the entire American body politic has really unsettled Europeans and really left them thinking about what are the anchors of their world and how can these be re-established?
Yeah, and
I also
go on, Melissa.
To be fair, that you know Trump has done well in the relationship with China. Mm. If you look at as we are at the 100 days now, if you look at some of the fears we had, campaign promises that he was going to label China as a currency manipulator, he was going to put tariff on Chinese goods, he was refusing to accept one China, that these were going to be things that were really quite disastrous for the region and for Australia. And what we've seen is much milder. So you look at the Mar-a-Lago Xi Trump summit, and it was all
whatever
very
that
positive.
Was.
Yeah. But bear in mind, it's only 100 days, and as always with this president, it's impossible to judge whether he means what he says or even if he understands the significance of what he says. Seriously.
And then the question is, when does the other shoe fall? When does someone from his own party or his own base stand up and say, listen, Mr. Trump, you've soft-pedaled on the Chinese, your threat action gap is enormous on China, and yet the trade deficit continues to billow out. Mm. How does that react with the Trump personality, and what does he do in response?
Point.
Well, that's for future foreign affairs. let's hope it's not too dramatic. Look, I want to thank you all. A very interesting discussion. Michael Wesley, Melissa Connolly-Tyre and Tom Switzer, thank you very much.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Thanks, everybody.
And Michael is from the ANU at the College of Asia and the Pacific. Melissa Connolly-Tyre is the National Executive Director of the AIIA, Australian Institute of International Affairs. And Tom, of course, presents Between the Lines and Sunday Extra here on RN.